Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, presented by Inforum, a division of the club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Richard Dare, President and CEO of Pacific Rim Partners, and this evening's moderator for the event, Tim Brown, Change by Design. Tim, you are President and CEO of IDEO, written for Harvard Business Review. You were on the cover of Business Week. Were you ever on the cover of Time?
No, not yet, anyway. Maybe one day.
Well, hopefully.
That'd be nice.
You've spoken at the World Economic Forum, TED Conference, and your firm's won more medals for innovative design than anyone in the world. Is that true?
I think that's true, yes.
More than Brezhnev?
For innovative design, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how many he won for innovation. But
Your book, Change by Design, is a blueprint showing us how to use design thinking to approach creative problem solving. Start us out just with the basic question. What is design thinking?
It's a way of helping us kind of speed up the innovation process, I think. And it really begins with, it really starts with human beings and what we need as human beings and what I would call human-centered design. And then uses uses creative tools, the kind of tools of designers like observation, experimentation, prototyping, storytelling, to get to creative alternatives to new solutions that we haven't seen before.
How is it different from analytical thinking?
Well, analytical thinking is about taking a complex problem, breaking it up into pieces, studying each of those pieces, putting it back together again, and ultimately, I think, largely making the best choice out of the available alternatives. Design thinking is about synthesis. It's about divergence. It's about trying to create new choices that haven't existed before.
Is there something wrong with analytical thinking?
Nothing wrong with analytical thinking at all, except that it largely leads to optimization rather than innovation.
And what's the problem with that in your...
Nothing wrong with optimization, except when you're looking for new ideas. And, I really think that we've focus, particularly in business, but you could argue perhaps in society as a whole, so much on analytical thinking as the source of how we do things that it's useful to think about perhaps beginning to balance that out with more creative forms of thinking.
How is it? Is design thinking similar or different? Is it the same as intuition?
Design thinking certainly relies on intuition to a degree. Intuition is one part of design thinking, but it's not everything. For me, intuition is this amazing ability we have as human beings to do complex pattern recognition, take a lot of different insights, some of which we hardly are even conscious about, and from that somehow get to some idea about what could be or what should be. And that's extremely powerful. But you need to inform that intuition. And I think one of the key things about design thinking is that there are ways of informing that intuition, particularly based on getting out into the world and really studying how people behave, really kind of observing quite closely how things happen around us. And it's sometimes it's very conscious and sometimes it's quite kind of unconscious that it's those observations that feed our intuition and sort of tell us kind of what feels right and what the right solutions might be.
Okay. Can you give us a concrete example of something where you used design thinking, where it worked, it accomplished something great, and then after that, let's break it down and tell us what the pattern is.
One example, sort of a local example for an organization that actually used to be just based up the road, but now I think it's based in Charlotte or something. I think that's Bank of America, a few years ago we worked with them to look at why people weren't saving very much in America, and what we could do to kind of encourage that. And we were particularly interested in kind of boomer families and parents, and we spent some time working with them and studying them. And what actually came out of that process was something that's called Keep the Change, which some people, I don't know if anybody here has a Keep the Change account. And what Keep the Change allows you to do is save automatically. It's a very simple simple way of when you pay anything on your debit card, the change gets the difference between that and the nearest dollar gets rounded up, and the change is put into your savings account, and it's resulted in billions of dollars of savings and millions of new accounts for Bank of America.
Okay, now, so see, to me, I see that as a good idea. Sounds like a great idea, splendid idea, but I don't understand how that's design thinking.
So the way
how design thinking got you.
How we got there was we started off doing exactly what I talked about, which is going out and following people around, literally in their homes, going shopping with them, really looking at what they were doing when they were kind of handling money. And we noticed two really interesting behaviors. One was that some people would round up their utility bills. And we could see them doing this. They showed us their utility bill, and they'd paid $30 instead of $28.50. And we're like, well, why did you do that? And it turned out that these were people who didn't want to ever get behind the utility company. They always sort of wanted to be ahead, didn't want to be surprised. So that was an interesting insight. And then the other behavior that we saw is one that we all recognize, of course, we've all done it, which is when people would go and pay for a cash transaction, they would take the coins that they got as change, and instead of spending them, they take them home, stick them in a jam jar, and or a piggy bank or something, and then every so often they'd give that to the kids to pay into their savings account or pay into their own savings account. And in both cases, what we were seeing was this sort of automatic kind of saving money kind of idea. And so we recognized that insight. And then we were kind of thinking about, well, how might we use those behaviors? We realized that if we put it together with this idea of a debit card or a credit card, we could create a new kind of savings service. And so then we designed the website and everything else that went around that in order to make that easy for people to do.
And so I want to push just a little bit on that again. The only part I heard that was unique in that, it sounded like, was that you observed people.
Well, it's about
in terms of the process.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, it really is about understanding potential behavior, understanding what people do in the world, and using that as a source of inspiration for new ideas. And then there was all of the kind of normal things that we do as designers, which is kind of coming up with new ways of using those insights, prototyping those ideas, trying them out quickly, developing them, evolving them, and then ultimately launching it as a product or as a service in this case.
I think I'm getting it. I'm getting closer to it. I'd read your book, and that was one of the challenges that I had with it, was it had a lot of really great stories. It was harder for me to see what was the process that you were talking about. Can you define the process anymore?
I've always believed that any creative process is not a kind of linear step-by-step, do this, and that you end up kind of cranking the handle and getting a result. And so what I've tried to do in the book is at least give people a set of tools, things that are important, this idea of observation, this idea of prototyping, this idea of experimentation, and then what I think is the best way to use those tools is very much dependent on the problem that you're trying to solve. So I would never expect to define a design process as being you always do this first, and then you always do this second, you always do this third. But it's a bit like the way a great cabinet maker works. They know the right moment to use the plane, they know the right moment to use the saw, they know when the right, and it's not necessarily always in the same order. And I think that's true of any kind of creative process. Because the moment it becomes too rote and too linear, you can drive the creativity actually out of it rather than into it.
So what types of things do you see beyond? I mean, often when people think of design, they think of designing the ergonomics around some small item. But you're talking about something bigger than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that clearly design has emerged as a profession, if you like, from the from things like product design, graphic design, architecture, where we were designing kind of tangible things, physical things, or posters, or books, or stuff like that, And a lot of the skills that have been developed to tackle those problems, I think, are relevant to a broader set of things. And so today, I think we see designers working on the design of new services. We see design thinking being used to design new processes, new ways things get done within organizations, within institutions. We clearly see design getting used to develop solutions to problems that are more systemic, that aren't just about how we do something very simple like make a phone call or operate a computer.
So what are the sorts of problems that are keeping you up at night that you think this ought to be applied to?
Well, I mean, one of the big ones that I'm finding myself talking a lot about these days and working a lot on is around healthcare, for instance. I mean, we think about the healthcare debate that we have right now and the healthcare reform debate. A lot of it is about access. But if we really think about what it takes to get to a sustainable healthcare system where we can all have some level of health, both preventative health and curative health that helps cure sickness. If we're really going to get to that, there's going to have to be a tremendous amount of innovation, not just technical innovation, which we see lots of already, and which in some cases, of course, drives the cost of medicine up, but innovation about how we kind of almost every aspect of how we think about health, whether it's in innovation around helping us prevent chronic disease, how do we deal with obesity, how do we encourage people to take more exercise. There's a huge set of kind of interesting problems to tackle. Whether it's around how our healthcare system works more efficiently, we've been doing some quite interesting work with both Kaiser Permanente here on the West Coast and the Mayo Clinic in Rochester around how to improve kind of essentially healthcare processes through design and innovation. So one of the projects here was based working with nurses on how to improve knowledge sharing within the nursing environment, how to improve the patient experience. One of the ideas that came out of that was a way of changing shift that they designed themselves,
okay.
which took the time that they spend away from patients on average down from 12 minutes to 40 minutes down to 12 minutes. And what they realized as they were watching themselves do this process was that they would run off to the nurse's station and spend all this time sharing sticky notes about and writing on each other's scrubs about, well, Mrs. Jones on bed B has got this issue and Mr. So and so over here has got this problem, took all this time. Often, in fact, missing some of the more important kind of information about, oh, this person who sat over there, that's her husband, and those kinds of things often got missed. And so, what they tried out and experimented with, and ultimately prototyped and designed, was a way of changing shift in front of the patient. And they developed a little software tool that allowed them to do that. And so, not only did they, but by doing that, they spend much more time in front of the patients instead of away in the nurse's station. But the patients feel more confident about the information that's getting transferred, not surprisingly, because it's happening in front of them. And then thirdly, the nurses are actually much more satisfied too. Partly, I think, because they've developed a solution for themselves that works better, and partly because they get ahead of the whole process. So that's just one small example, and there were many, many other innovations that came out of the work that the nurses at Kaiser have done that improves the efficiency of a healthcare process. And I think there are thousands of those kinds of opportunities in healthcare.
Right. And the way that was design thinking, rather than just good consulting was what?
Because they, as I said before, they spent time observing what was really happening. They got together and kind of brainstormed new solutions together. Okay. They prototyped those ideas very quickly. So instead of waiting until they could build a piece of software to make it work, they just did it with pieces of paper in front of the patient. And then they figured out, oh, yeah, it worked. And they did it in one hospital. And then they realized then they tried it out in a second hospital. And then ultimately they built this piece of software that makes it a lot easier to scale. So it was this kind of incremental process of trying things out and experimenting until they get to the right solution.
Right. And when you mentioned the brainstorming part, what is it that, if on that segment of the process, such as it is, what are the mistakes that people make when they brainstorm?
Well, I think people use the term brainstorming very loosely, and I think of it a bit like it's a team sport. You know, it's a bit like playing, well, football where I come from, which would be soccer here, right? Which is if you don't play by the rules, chances are you're not going to have a very good game at the end of the day, And brainstorming's a bit like that. There are certain kind of rules about how it should be done, I think, that allow it to work extremely productively. And when you don't play by those rules, it actually is not a very good way of having ideas. And I think there are lots of them, but the most important one, in my opinion, is for brainstorming to be a successful process. It's about being collaborative enough to be willing to build on other people's ideas. So I think we tend to think of a brainstorm as being everybody sat around a table firing off their own ideas, and somebody's up on the wall madly scrawling away trying to record them all. And And instead, when you see a really good group of people brainstorming, you'll find an idea will move around the table, each person kind of building on it until it gets better and better and better to the point where it's a really interesting and good idea.
So take it to Congress right now. If we look at our healthcare debate, if you could go
can
to that
you imagine
group of people,
Congress brainstorming?
Yeah.
It's a question. I don't know.
Imagine you became king for the day here in America. And what would you have them do? How would that work?
Well, it's an interesting question is whether it would be actually possible in that culture to get people to build on other people's ideas.
Where would you start?
You'd start by asking a relatively focused question, like, you know, how could we get, you know, more people to go visit their doctor to talk about preventative health? I don't know, or whatever it might be, some relatively focused question, and then you try and get that group of people to kind of start with ideas. Well, what about if we did this? And then you'd rather hope that somebody else will say, well, that's an interesting idea, but what if you took that idea and added this to it and made it a more interesting idea? And, oh, well, what if people, part of it was paid by the insurance company, but part of it was paid some other way? Well, that would be an interesting idea. And so you try and get this notion that these ideas can kind of flow and get built on, and then they can become quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a question, I guess, around the point of where does the original, who originally defines the problem? I think quoted Henry Ford, who said, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very underappreciated part of any creative process. And it's actually one of the places where, you know, I have this conversation quite often with scientists or people who look at science and say science is a very, very analytical process based on this very rigid methodology. And it is until you go all the way back to the beginning and say, well, how do you come up with a hypothesis in the first place? Mm-hmm. That hypothesis is often a really interesting, somewhat intuitive question about why is this the way it is, or how might we study this? And it's exactly the same with the design process, that question that you ask is really important and often needs to get kind of asked many times. I mean, I often find when we're working on a design problem is you think you're asking one question, then you go and learn a little bit and actually realize, you know, actually the question is better framed a slightly different way. Or we thought we were trying to solve a problem for these people, or we thought that it was about this technology. Well, actually, no, let's throw the technology out and focus on the people or whatever it might be. So you find yourself developing and evolving this question. But that question that gets asked right at the beginning, you know, really does have a huge impact on the quality of solutions that come out at the end.
You tell the story of Shimano, the bicycle parts manufacturer.
Right.
Were they asking the right question at the beginning?
Well, no, actually, they didn't. And it was interesting. They came and said, "What would it be like to create a luxury bike for ordinary consumers?" And we didn't think that was maybe the right question to ask. And we went and spent a little bit of time kind of looking at people and think, you know, when we go and meet and talk to people and watch people and ask them about bicycling and cycling, and they all say a set of interesting things. One is they say most of them don't ride bikes now, and every one of them said they rode a bike as a kid.
Okay.
And every one of them said they had great memories of riding a bike as a kid. So maybe the question is less, How do we develop a high-end bike for ordinary consumers? And instead, the question should be, how can we make cycling like it was for people when they were kids?
Right.
And let's look at the problem that way. And when you do that, you find yourself wanting to design something that's incredibly simple, that's really robust, that can be kind of left in the garage for a couple of weeks, dragged out, and it's still going to work. And you're not going to have to pump the tires up. And a whole bunch of kind of outcomes that came out of asking a slightly different question than the one that was there right at the beginning.
So what did it end up with?
Well, it ended up being not only a range of bicycles from various manufacturers, which were extremely simple, which used some very simple computer technology to allow people to not even have to worry about changing gear, which was kind of interesting, and tires you didn't have to pump up, and a whole series of other things. But also, in addition, it was a new kind of retail experience. And one of the things, I don't know about you, I'm not much of a cyclist, and when I go into the local bicycle store, store where I live in Palo Alto and see all these kids in Lycra who look like they've just run a marathon, I'm pretty intimidated. And I don't really want to go up to them and ask them, you know, I'd like a bike. I just want to cycle to Starbucks and back.
Right.
You know, I mean, what would that be? Like, you know, and they give you this withering look. Right. And say, well, you know, if you're not going to go up to the top of Skyline and back on your Sunday morning ride, we're not interested. So part of it was trying to design a retail experience that might kind of get more ordinary people into bicycle stores.
Since you're on bicycles, tell us about the aqueduct.
So the aqueduct was an interesting little one of those things that happens when somebody asks an interesting question. In this case, it was Google and Specialized asked an interesting question.
Okay.
They decided they were going to run a little competition called Innovate or Die, which was a great name for competition, I thought, and that they wanted the most innovative use of bicycle technology that might help the world. And so this was a 2-week competition, I think I'm right in saying, or 2 or 3 weeks. It was very short, and one of a bunch of folks at IDEO decided they were going to enter it in their spare time. This was just kind of an evening project for them, and so in that 2 weeks they decided that they were going to look at water as the thing they were interested in with bicycles. So in that couple of weeks they developed this idea, which is this tricycle with a tank on the back, and you can pedal it down to a water source, fill it up, and while you're pedaling home, it pumps the water through a filter and cleans the water.
Right.
So that by the time you get back,
it's got to be quite the ride home.
filled
with water and pumping it through.
Yeah. You certainly get some extra exercise. You know, you're carrying 20 pounds of extra water, and it was a really interesting response to a question. They did an amazing job. In 2 weeks, they built a fully working prototype and made a movie of it. And the entry to the competition was to put up a YouTube movie, a 2-minute YouTube movie. So they posted it. It's had well over a million downloads now, and they won the competition. And you know, it's a half developed idea, to be really honest with you.
Right.
I mean, it was, you know, we can do a lot in 2 weeks, but only so much in two
weeks.
Sure. And you know, there are lots of, well, it's an expensive bicycle, and would people really want to pedal these things around lanes in India? But since then, we've, you know, been some interesting thinking about, well, maybe it could be a basis for a delivery, you know, a delivery network for water in urban areas, for instance, rather than rural. Who knows? But it's a nice example of somebody asking a sort of fairly open-ended, but at the same time quite constrained question, and that's really the key to asking the right question. It's got to be open enough to give you some space to innovate, but have enough kind of edges to it. There's something to push against. Now, in this case, one of the edges was you've got 2 weeks.
Sure.
And that turns out to be one of the quite important things
in
to
real
think
life
about.
Pushes
in real
edges,
life, I mean, deadlines.
Like,
I mean,
technology.
I'm a creative person. If I didn't have deadlines,
that.
I'd never get anything finished. I mean, I would keep designing literally into infinity if I didn't have a deadline.
But the feasibility to
and most designers
expense,
have the same time. Eventually, you got to. So feasibility is one. Time is another one. Kind of who you're focusing on the problem might be another one. I mean, there are lots of different constraints you can put in place, and the trick is to get that balance. If they're too narrow, if it's do. Please design me a new water glass, and it's got to cost exactly the same amount of this one. Oh, and it's got to use clear plastic, and it's got to be about the same volume. Chances are you're not going to get anything very different from this water cup. But if instead it was design me a new low cost way of consuming water, maybe you get something quite different. Maybe it wouldn't even be a cup. Maybe it would be something completely different. So that question is
typically
really, really important.
In this sort of process, who do you think ought to be involved? And think of it in a company, in a family, in an NGO, in any type of group, who would be involved in this sort of design thinking process for creating changes? Do you hire your company there?
We love it when people do that, of course.
Who are the best participants?
I think everybody can be a participant in design thinking. Now, there are skills. I mean, it turns out that kids are already well equipped to be design thinkers, and they're pretty they haven't had it beaten out of them yet.
Okay.
We do quite a lot of work with kids. We design quite a lot of toys and educational stuff and things, and bring kids into. And have them work with us, and they are incredibly creative. They're quite They're quite good at brainstorming, particularly young girls. We did a really interesting experiment once, unintentional experiment, where we brought two groups of, I think there were 7 or 8 year old girls and boys in to work on a project one day. It was a Saturday morning. You know, we kind of fed them pancakes and played a few games with them and said, okay, we want you to come and help us design new exercise toys, I think it was. And we put all the boys in one room and all the girls in another room. And an hour later, the boys had got to about 50 or 60 ideas, and the girls had got to 200 ideas.
Oh, my goodness.
And this takes me back to the point I was making before. There was, one reason for them, you could see it happening, is that the boys were no good at being collaborative. And they just, idea after idea after day, they were shouting over each other. And the girls were really good at listening to one another's ideas and building on it. And so they were firing off these ideas, but each one was a response to the other. So they were much more productive for that hour. Anyhow, so that was interesting, an interesting little experiment. So I think young girls are particularly good at design thinking. But it turns out, you know, they go to school and they get told about, you know, they get sort of all this analytical stuff beaten into them and all this other creative stuff beaten out of them. So kids are good.
Within a typical company, who ought to be on the design team?
Well, it depends on the problem, right? I mean, okay.
You said a lot of people have Skunkworks.
Mattel had this really interesting little group that they put together for a while called Platypus. And in that, they brought people from all over the organization. And P&G has got a similar thing now, actually, set up by the same people. And they bring finance people and marketing people and designers and engineers, R&D folks, into these programs. They'll last about 3 months, and they'll pick an area of the business, and they'll try and reinvent it in some way. And they spend the first couple of weeks going through a kind of a boot camp, which is sort of, you know, basically teaching them how to do design thinking. Because there are, you know, there are skills that you need to learn. And then they'll spend the next 10 or 12 weeks trying to come up with some new kind of breakthrough idea. It does work. I mean, it doesn't work every time. And just like it doesn't work every time when you put professionally trained designers together either. But it does work. I mean, P&G have had some really interesting new brands that they've launched through this thing they call Clay Street. And you know, and similarly, just like we got it to work with working with nurses and doctors in a hospital. I mean,
Where would the borders of this be where it doesn't work, do you think? I mean, what are the sorts of problems that it wouldn't?
It doesn't work if the problems are too abstract and open, for sure. I mean, so there's a type of problem that it...
Russia's just launched bombs, and they're going to hit in 5 minutes.
It's probably a little late to be...
That's very specific.
You know, there's that wonderful... I mean, you know, I think one of the best kind of examples on film of that kind of process going on. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Apollo 13. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that moment where they have to try and figure out how to make that kind of square filter fit in a round hole because the filters in the landing module and the command module were different. And they get a bunch of engineers in a room with a bunch of parts, and they literally brainstorm and build for hours until they get to a solution. That's actually a great example of design thinking going on in action. In this case, in a relatively high pressure situation. But I mean, clearly it took hours, not minutes.
You say that focus groups don't offer a lot of insight.
Well, I think the problem with focus groups is you get to that Henry Ford problem, which is focus groups tend to be a format for asking people what they know they already want or they think they might already want, and people aren't very good at telling you about it. And the other thing that I find a bit... focus groups can be okay for getting response to ideas you've already had.
Right.
So you can take early ideas to a focus group and you can get quite good responses. You can do that online, you can do that physically. But it's not very good for coming up with ideas in the first place. And they say there's two reasons. One is people tend to not be all that imaginative about what they might want when you ask them. And secondly, they actually don't know how they behave. If you ask somebody, so tell me what kind of food you eat in a focus group, and they'll tell you all this stuff about all this healthy food you eat.
Sure.
And then you go back and take them into their kitchen. You start opening cupboards, and you know, you find all kinds of junk food, and they're eating it every day. But they've somehow forgotten. It's not that they're telling, you know, lies or untruths. We all do this. We sort of massage our worlds into fit the way we'd like to be, particularly when we're trying to keep somebody happy who's asking us a question. So focus groups have all those kinds of problems, and I think direct observation with people, you know, in their homes, in their offices, you know, out in the world, where is much more productive.
You, as one of the forms of direct observation, you talk about building empathy with the client or with the user, with the human who's going to be affected most by this. And you tell a story about trying to develop a better gurney at DePaul Medical Center in St. Louis.
Right.
What give us the short version of the story and Yeah, I mean, how does that fit into design thinking?
Well, so the story was, again, we were looking at emergency rooms in hospitals and wondering about how they might be better and how we particularly might make the patient experience in an emergency room a little better, because it adds a lot of extra stress to whatever you've already got as a problem when you go in there. So one of our designers decided that, you know, the best way to get some insights about it was to go through the experience himself and sort of fake that he got a problem. So he kind of went into the emergency room with a kind of fake emergency and just went through the whole process.
And nobody in the hospital knew it was fake.
Well, he did have a big video camera next to his head, which helped kind of give it away a little bit. Yeah. And it did prevent them sticking him with needles and things, which he wasn't too keen on that idea. But there were a whole series of things, like he didn't know where to go when he walked in the emergency room. But the one of the more interesting kind of observations that he had or experience that he had was that at one point they got really busy and he was on a gurney and they shoved him out into a hallway. And while they went and dealt with other people, and they just left him there, and so when he came back with that videotape, and we were reviewing the videotape, at one point there were 20 minutes of the acoustic ceiling tiles in the hallway of the hospital, and that was that simple observation, both for him was the fact he was left there, but for us to see that, one kind of response to that is, wow, you could do a much better job of designing the acoustic ceiling tiles of hospitals so that it was less boring to look at them. But or you could think, as soon as you think about that, immediately you can imagine how he's there lying on this gurney with noises going on all around him, staring into the ceiling, not knowing what's going on, how uncertain that must be, how worrisome that must be, how frustrating that must be, all these things. And so how can we design a system where at least they know what's going on, or he knows how long he's going to be there, or all these things you can do to make the process more comforting and more and less unpleasant.
So you sat and brainstormed. You observed all that. You brainstormed all of that. Then you began prototyping what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all kinds of things. You know, in that particular project, we were interested in, you know, how does somebody navigate into the system more effectively? So, for instance, who do they know? Who should they ask questions of? Because it's not much use asking the hall porter, you know, what's wrong with you. It might be useful to ask a nurse or a doctor. So one of the things that came out of that project, for instance, was that in the emergency room, all of the staff wear these kind of scrub-like things anyway, but with great big graphics on them that say, doctor, nurse, porter, so that you know who's who. And if you've got a question, at least you got a chance you're going to ask the right person. There were navigation systems.
I'm with him.
There were sort of, printed on the floor. There were go here and then go here. Just ways of sort of stepping people through the process when they walk in the door so that they're more likely to go through the right place.
So they asked for a gurney, and this is what you gave them.
Well, they didn't ask for a gurney. They didn't actually know what they were asking for. They were asking to make the emergency room experience a better experience for patients.
Right. Do you think any of it? Have you thought about whether design thinking applies to the family unit? You know, if I have a 14-year-old son, I want him to go to bed on time.
Good.
Help
luck.
Me out, Doc.
Good
what
luck.
Do I, what do I do?
Good
here?
Luck. Good luck.
Sit down. Should we brainstorm? What's the?
Yeah, I don't know.
Prototype?
I haven't tried. I didn't even bother trying with that one with my kids. But I often think about things like designing events for the family. I mean, a dinner party or something. I mean, you can definitely use this idea of how do we create a better experience? I mean, how can we make this experience something that's really unique? And you can watch what people do today, or you can learn from previous experiences you've had. You can obviously try ideas out, as a group in the family. You can prototype ideas, try something out this time that you might even perfect for the next time you do a dinner party. I think just thinking creatively about, particularly about events that you do as a family, can actually ultimately lead to things that are more rewarding and satisfying and can be quite good fun, particularly if you've got kids that you can bring into the process.
At what point do you start culling the ideas down? You know, when you're brainstorming, you're coming up with ideas, everything's flowing freely and so forth, is there some point where you
Well, this is actually
at some point you've got to start throwing things out.
No, exactly. This is actually where you bring analytical thinking back in to some degree. Is one of the first things you do is you got a lot of ideas and you knew you had some constraints going in, right? So you had these things you were trying to achieve going in, and so you start to say, okay, well, which of our ideas might actually fit with these constraints and which ones don't? You start to throw out some of the ones that don't, unless they're really interesting in another way, in which case you might keep. Sometimes you just come up with something that's so interesting you want to keep it alive, but really the key, I think, to developing ideas and deciding which ones work is to start making prototypes. Now, if that's a product, then you start building prototypes using the simplest materials you can. That often might be paper and cardboard and plasticine and other kind of simple materials. And you know, I've seen leaders of multi-billion-dollar businesses on the floor building cardboard prototypes of ideas that they've that they're having and deciding whether they've got an interesting idea very quickly.
Right.
If it's not a product, but it's a service or an experience that you're trying to make, I mean, then you might act it out. You might use, we try and encourage and try and teach our people and people we work with how to use improv acting skills, for instance, to try something out. And you might do that if it's an obvious. So, for instance, you're designing a new restaurant experience, for instance, and what's it like to go into the restaurant? What's it like to find it? What's the service going to be like? Then you can use improv acting to try that out. We also use those same kind of skills when we're designing software too. We often actually have people play the role of the pieces of software early on before we actually want to start programming things. Then we might go onto paper and start making little paper prototypes, and then eventually start building. Then you start building stuff in real technology. Because the thing is, it's a lot of work to build real stuff. It's a lot of work to build things using technology. And if it's much better to figure out how you can improve your idea before you put all that effort in than after. And so I have this idea that we have this idea which we saw, just enough prototyping. What's the minimum amount you can do to learn something about your idea and then improve it? Not how complex can my prototype be.
Right.
That's how you get these, tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of prototypes that then you kind of throw away
Dr.
at the end.
Emmett Brown.
And the worst thing about doing that is not that you've spent lots of money, it's that when you've spent so much money on a prototype, you're really reluctant to decide it's a bad idea.
Sure.
You're really reluctant to give up, which means you tend then to stick with ideas for much longer than you should. Now, eventually, you'll probably decide it's a bad idea. But if that's just before you launch it, or even worse, just after you've launched it, then you can have wasted millions of dollars, and that, that's not a good thing to do.
There was a point where you talked about buzz being a clue as you're prototyping that certain items, if they're creating a buzz, that's one of your clues. Is that real?
I think sometimes it can be very hard, particularly if your idea is quite different and it's quite a breakthrough. It can be very hard to get any sort of real data on how good your idea is.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things that can be most instructive is if you've got a new idea and you take it out, perhaps you do go to focus groups or some kind of qualitative testing for your idea and you're trying it out. It can be more interesting to get a few people really passionate about your idea than lots of people kind of mediocre about it. And that buzz that those few people are kind of generating about that idea can be actually more indicative that you've got a big idea on your hands than if lots of people say it's okay. Because it turns it because then what might be about to happen is that you'll get some people who are real supporters of your idea. They're the kind of early adopters. They're the indicators that there might be some new behavior that you've got that other people will adopt when they see how interesting it is. But they may not see it the first time you show it to them. So buzz can actually be quite an indicator that you've got something quite interesting.
You also talk about an idea that. That it's important for firms and for people and for groups to pursue things that are going to stretch them far beyond their base or core skills. And you give the example of the Toyota Prius as that. Why is it important, and why specifically that example?
Well, I thought what was interesting about the Prius is that Toyota has this huge reputation in the world for being wonderful incremental innovation, and they do have this incredibly sophisticated process for constantly improving the quality of their products on the production line and everywhere else. And so everybody tends to think of them as being the kind of epitome of efficiency and optimization.
Right.
And I think what they showed with the Prius was a belief in a new way of in kind of this new platform, this idea of hybrid technology, before, you know, before the oil crisis, long before people in this country were talking about needing more fuel-efficient vehicles. And because they got to it long before, when they launched it, the timing was perfect, you know, and they ended up capturing a lot more market share than I think even they expected, given how long the delays were on ordering them when they first came out.
So we have our own auto industry here in the U.S. that is challenged.
Kind of.
And what should we be thinking about? What would be the big ideas? How would we get to them? And what in your mind, should we be trying to make better cars out of General Motors?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's clearly going to be a continued need for transportation, you know, forward into the future. We're not going to stop moving around. I think what the American car industry suffered from was incrementalism. You know, a form of incrementalism which I think was quite dangerous, which was based on an assumption that what we already provide is what the market wants more of, and
faster horses.
Faster horses. Yeah, they kind of didn't live by Henry Ford's.
So what should the question
idea.
Be that we?
I think the questions should be things like, well, what do we really need in terms of personal transportation in the future? What the different kinds of markets need? I mean, you know, I think there was the Japanese and to some degree the Europeans realized long before that we did here that actually not everybody who buys a car is a 25-year-old male who wants a you know a sports car or a muscle car. That actually there are markets for cars for people who actually don't care about cars. It took a long time I'm still not entirely sure the American car industry gets that idea that there's actually a market for cars for people who don't actually like driving very much, but they do want to get around and they want it to be highly convenient, really easy, incredibly reliable, super practical. And the Japanese companies particularly understood that, and have everything since the kind of the first Honda Civics and Preludes and things from the 1970s have tried to deliver vehicles that were extremely extremely practical and simple and weren't really about being a petrol head. And so that's just one example, I think, of the kinds of questions that car companies should be asking.
A part of that seems to be decoupling from the existing technologies or the existing answers and so forth. You give another example of HBO doing that, trying to tell that story quickly. And how does that tie it to design thinking?
Well, you know, I think one tends to think of media companies as being all about content, and of course, HBO is probably the best example, or one of the best examples we have in the United States, of a company that's built a great brand, a media company that's built a great brand around content. But they were smart enough to realize that they were tied to a delivery platform, cable, that you know that is not going to be around forever, and that they could already see their customers, their end consumers, not the cable companies, you know, interested in other things. And so what they wanted to do is imagine what that future would be like. And so the team that worked with them not only imagined how the technology platforms were going to change, TV over the internet, TV over our mobile phones, over our laptops, et cetera, but also about, you know, how, you know, particularly kids and were wanting to interact with content differently. And so they created this whole sort of vision of the future of HBO and HBO programming, running on all kinds of different devices and platforms with all new kinds of features, built that out as a sort of all working prototypes in HBO's headquarters in New York, and really use it as a way of kind of educating the leadership of the company how their future might change, and educating their partners. So out of that came their first deal with AT&T to put Entourage on mobile phones, and that was about four years ago now.
Very interesting. In just a few moments, by the way, we're going to be taking questions from the audience. So if you have anything that you'd like to ask Tim, please line up at one of the microphones on either the right hand or the left side of the audience, and we'll be happy to take your questions in just a few moments here. This is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, and tonight we're hosting Tim Brown, Change by Design. I'm Richard Dare, President and CEO of Pacific Rim Partners, moderator for the evening. I'm in discussion with Tim Brown, the author of Change by Design and CEO of IDEO. Tim, you give an example, a large social example, around Cool Biz.
Mm.
that was done in Japan mm-hmm. with the Hakuhodo. What happened there? And again, tie it as tightly as you can. Make a tight knot for a very ignorant moderator as to why that is design change.
Well, I think that example for me is really about the power of story. Is really about the power of storytelling when it comes to changing behavior. And you know, one of the kind of typical sorts of design problems I think we face today is how do we change our behavior around things like climate change? And so this I thought was just a wonderful example of Hakuhodo, that's a marketing and advertising agency in Japan, working with the Japanese government to look at how might we use less energy, and this is particular in the summertime. And again, one of the things that they recognized was that one of the things that was stopping was causing air conditioning systems to be turned up so low, I suppose, in terms of temperature in Japan, was that everybody was wearing these. All the guys are wearing these formal suits and ties and everything, and so they were warm when they were in the office. So the idea was, well, what if we can encourage people to wear more casual clothing, open neck clothing, that sort of thing? Change the way Japanese businessmen behave, at work. Oh, and by the way, that would mean that then Japanese women did not have to put blankets over their knees when they were sat at their desks because they were freezing cold in their business skirts.
So how did they do it?
What they did was they got a bunch of Japanese fashion designers to design a whole series of range of clothing. They then got the CEOs of every major corporation in Japan, plus the Japanese Prime Minister, to do these fashion shows where they were modeling all of these new clothes. And they then did this other thing where we could do that. They started. In Silicon Valley, we're already most of the way there. We don't have to worry about it. They did this thing called Cool Biz, and they created this thing where anybody that was wearing a Cool Biz badge in an organization that signed up to this idea of Cool Biz,
yes.
You couldn't question whether they were wearing casual okay. clothes, which in Japan is a big deal, right? The rules are really important. You work there a lot, And so this was a way of giving express permission right. for people to wear casual right. clothes. And so it was those two things. It was the clothing, or three things, really. The clothing, the sort of the CEOs kind of modeling the behavior, and then the badge, which gave explicit permission for
right.
people.
Right.
And they reduced the settings on the on average on all of the air conditioning systems, I think, from 26 to 23 degrees, sorry, 23 to 26 degrees, which turns out to save megatons of carbon over time.
Trillions of dollars, sure.
I think it's just a really nice example of how design from a sense of kind of clothing, the badges and all that kind of stuff, and the system, plus storytelling, led to this change in behavior.
Great. We'll take some questions now. Sir, why don't we start from you?
Hi, my name is Lyle, and I was wondering, have you used children to address big world problems? You talked about using them to design toys, but I was wondering if so, and what exactly.
Are we looking to the kids to solve all our big world problems?
Well, I think, when we're talking about these issues of significant behavior change, one place to start, which is very impactful, I think, is to start with kids and have them both take on new behaviors that ultimately they take through the rest of their lives. And there's lots and lots of initiatives going on around kids and climate change, and kids designing new recycling programs and designing new ways of saving energy in the home, and they're both extremely kind of enthusiastic about it. They can have quite an effect on their parents, and more importantly, they build in behaviors now that they're likely to live with through the rest of their lives. I think in terms of health, that's
and they're cheap labor too.
And they're cheap labor. Yes, that's also true. They can't. Yeah. Lots of ideas doesn't cost very much. I think with healthcare, one of the best things we could do is figure out how to equip kids with the life skills to think about health and differently, to manage their health,
sure.
to understand the relationship between food and exercise and health. And because if we do that, they're likely to take that through the rest of their lives, instead of those who are unfortunate enough to grow up in kind of the time when it was all about convenience food and it was all about processed food and nobody understood the relationship with exercise.
Absolutely. So, yes, sir.
So I have a question pertaining a little bit more to the situation groups are put in. You talk a lot about the process to design innovatively, but when I think about most corporations or groups, you have leadership that says, why isn't my group innovative, and by the time it gets to the bottom, someone goes to an employee and says, okay, I want an innovative solution for you, grabs a glass of water and says, where is it? And so can you speak at all to how leadership could really make a situation, whether it's more free time to be innovative, whatever it is, to where groups can really grow okay. into that? Because I think
how can leadership foster this?
I think just in a way, as I said before, these kinds of processes are not kind of linear, prescribed processes, but they're kind of as much as an attitude as anything else. That means that you have to think about culture. And you have to create a culture where innovation is supported and enabled. I mean, if people can't take risks, they're not going to innovate. If people aren't given space to have ideas, they're not going to have ideas. And if people aren't rewarded, and I don't mean necessarily explicitly rewarded through better through pay or bonuses or other, but rewarded kind of socially within the culture for having new ideas, then they won't have new ideas. And so, for me, the principal role of leadership. Is to support a culture of innovation, not to tell people to innovate, not even necessarily to tell people what to innovate around, although they can certainly help by asking the interesting questions.
Sure.
But it's to support a culture of innovation, which means support the emergence of ideas. It means encouraging, particularly middle management, to expect to have portfolios of new ideas coming up through their bits of the organization. I think, you know, one thing that A.G. Lafley did, for instance, at P&G, was demand that every one of his presidents of his business units had an innovation portfolio that he reviewed with them, and still, well, now he's retired, but every 6 months, which went from extreme innovation, you know, breakthrough innovation to incremental innovation. They had to come and show exactly what was going on inside their organization every 6 months and show that they were managing this portfolio. And I think those kinds of things can really help.
Wonderful. Yes, sir.
Hi, Tim. Thank you. I haven't actually read the book, but
you may need to step a little closer to the microphone.
Oh, can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Go ahead.
My name is Sudeep. I'm curious if you've covered in your work or if you've covered in the book problems that relate to not necessarily the development of a product, but more, for example, how to make voting more accurate or representative of the population, or how to reduce corruption in, let's say, India or somewhere like that, in terms of politicians accepting bribes. Have we tackled some problems like that?
I don't explicitly talk about that in the book, and I think it's one of those places where this relationship between policy and behavior is one where I think there's a role for design thinking, but it certainly isn't going to solve the problem all on its own. It may be one of these places that you talked about earlier where it may be important, but not sufficient. I think it's clearly one place where design thinking can make a difference is around this idea of transparency and around making things transparent and design. I mean, the financial system is one place where I think there are many things that we could do to make the way our financial systems work more transparent, such that it would be harder for things to go quite so disastrously wrong, perhaps. And we've started to tackle that at an individual level. So, you know, we're seeing, you know, pieces of software get developed that allow people to manage their own finances in a way that's more transparent. They can see what's going on. They can see when they're spending money and when money's coming in, and make decisions that help them manage their money more effectively. And it would be interesting to imagine how that was done on a more kind of systemic level. I think when it comes to kind of corruption and politics, I think you can imagine there are things that can be designed to help. But equally, I think there's a lot of other things that, I mean, around policy and that need to come alongside it. I'd certainly be interested in tackling those kinds of problems, though.
Yes, ma'am.
I think most designers would agree that the more you understand,
move
the
real
user,
close to the microphone.
Oh, sorry. Oh, too close.
No, move closer.
Oh, sorry. I think most designers would agree that the more you understand the user, the better your design is. Can you comment on the fact that Apple, which is known for innovative design, does little, if any, like usability testing or user research?
Actually, they do more than you think. And I mean, interestingly enough, the Apple research group in the 70s and 80s really developed a lot of the ideas that we use today in user research. So they've actually had quite a long history of it. But I think what's key to Apple is that they're really good about being their own users. And so, I mean, you can't do that for a lot of things. I mean, it's hard to be designing a new spinal surgery system and be your own user, right? I mean,
sure.
Unless you're unlucky enough to have gone through the experience, and then you'd have to be the surgeon as well, which would be really really quite difficult. But for certain things, and I think this is true for a lot of consumer products, I mean, really, really good user research can mean really using the stuff yourself. It can mean that. I'm not saying that will always lead you to the best solutions, but I do think that what they do is build things that are intuitive to them, and they work for many of us. They don't work for all of us, but they work for many of us. So, you know, I think that they have chosen to take a certain approach to developing their products and their experiences, and I think it works reasonably well for them. But
yes,
you know,
sir.
It's not the only way.
Go ahead.
What do you see as the future of design thinking as a business model? Firms like IDEO, you know, it seems I'm sure you have competition, but there's lots of advertising agencies and there's lots of management consulting firms, but I don't think you have a lot of competition. And how do you see that evolving?
I think what we've seen happen is that design's getting applied to this much broader world of problems today than it once was. That's interesting to other kinds of organizations, and we're starting to see some of the advertising agencies, some of the management consultancy firms get interested in design themselves, and that's interesting to see. And we'll continue to explore where the most interesting problems are and figure out how we can apply design to those. I think there are interesting questions about the role of very large collaborative networks in design and design thinking. Whether we'll start to see large numbers of people using the web to design together to create things. We're already seeing it, I think, quite successfully used in relatively incremental design innovation breakthroughs,
such as
Mozilla. I think it's a great example of Firefox is a great web browser. It's incrementally better than what was there before. It wasn't a completely new way of browsing the web, but it was done extremely effectively and collaboratively. And I think there's still a way to go yet before we understand how to use those same kinds of networks to do things that really are
to build a new car or something.
Significantly different from the things that are already in the world.
Okay.
But I think it's likely to happen eventually, and that'll be a kind of a new way of doing design.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you mentioned that
jump right up to the mic. And...
Okay, you mentioned that kids are inherently good at design thinking, and I'm wondering, let's say, what your advice would be when someone gets out of high school and maybe had an interest in design thinking, what your recommendation to them would be.
Well, there are many more choices than there used to be, and I mean, when I got interested in design, the only choice was really to go to art school, which is what I did for many many years. But today, for one, we've learned that great design thinking requires many different disciplines. So, you know, for instance, at IDEO, we have 50 or 60 different disciplines, people that come from everything from anthropology to engineering to, you know, architecture to design. We even have business people at IDEO.
God forbid.
God forbid. And there are more and more programs that offer some of these skills that are not traditional, you know, art and design schools. So whether it's the Stanford D School, for instance, which brings engineering students and business school students and medical school students together to tackle design problems using design thinking as a process, or you've got business schools like the Rotman School in Toronto. There are schools in Europe and schools across the
States. Now, notably, all of your examples are education examples. I'm just asking.
Yes.
Okay.
I guess I was answering the question is, if you're interested in design thinking and are leaving high school, then you know, there are educational options that are open today that are not the one that I felt was the only one that was open to me, which was to go to art school.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You spoke a little bit earlier about the limitations of design thinking, and you were saying that it might not work as well when the problem is very vague. And it seems like that's probably a problem for any type of approach, whether it's analytical thinking.
Good
and so I'm curious if the implication there was that another approach would be more successful if the problem is vague. Mm. And I'm also curious if you can maybe give a more concrete example of a time that design thinking failed and another approach would be better.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. There may not be too many approaches that are great for really vague, really vague problems.
Yeah.
So, hence, therefore, don't try and study vague problems. There are clearly places, you know, where we can see where, for instance, in the development of, you know, scientific ideas and technology ideas, where you really are trying to do the science, then then you know, then the scientific method is a wonderful problem-solving process for getting to scientific breakthroughs. And I think design can play its role in scientific breakthroughs, or particularly technology breakthroughs, kind of later on in the process when you're starting to figure out how to apply that technology to real-world problems. But when you're actually still doing the core science, it's pretty clear we've developed a methodology that's extremely valuable, and it's called a scientific method. However, I would say that one shift that we've seen that perhaps design can begin to show a way about how to do that is that, you know, for instance, in medicine, you know, I was at a big medical conference just last week, and one of the issues that was coming up there time and time again is the lack of collaboration in both research and patient care in medicine. And I think through design thinking, we have shown how you can collaboratively work together to solve problems. And so there might be an opportunity for science and design to learn a bit from each other around how to kind of collaborate more effectively to solve problems. Because today, science is largely, certainly in healthcare anyway, largely kind of an individual activity.
To what extent does the, just kind of following through with the last question, to what extent does, if the problem seems too large, too vague, is there a process that you could use design thinking to begin to narrow down what the problem is?
Well, I mean, one thing you could do is use a kind of a relative, I've seen, there are some interesting sort of semi-analytical processes that I've seen some strategic kind of consultants use where they kind of break these really huge problems up into kind of pieces. And they use sort of scenario planning like techniques, which we also use in design, but they use scenario planning techniques to do that. And then each of those scenarios can be an interesting design problem because it's at that point tight enough. It describes a particular world that might be, and then you can think about those as being that being a place in which you could do design. So those sorts of scenario planning kinds of activities can be quite useful ways of tackling relatively abstract mm-hmm. problems in the beginning.
Okay, good. Yes, sir.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for coming tonight. My name is Javier Cabra. I'm a teacher down in East Palo Alto. And I'm here with the dean of students from the high school. I'm here with someone from the D school from Stanford who they're teaching us or they're helping us understand design thinking so we can use it in the classroom.
Awesome. Go to your question.
So the question is, in a community like East Palo Alto where there's a high dropout rate and students come to us ninth grade with third, fourth, fifth grade reading levels and math levels, how can we sort of use this process so we don't kill the creative experience? Mm. At the same time, where the stakes are high, we need to keep our charter so that we right. can continue teaching where it's results-driven and standards-driven. And
yeah, I can only imagine results. That's incredibly challenging, and I think
that's
it's amazing that you're doing it. I think that... there is some evidence, and there's been quite some success in high schools around the country. I know in Philadelphia there's one very successful high school that uses design and a design approach to teach kids. And I think one of the things that they found is that for kids who may struggle with more conventional learning approaches, that design can be a way of learning through doing. That can be quite powerful for them, and I'm not an educationalist, so I mean you know much more about it than I do, but it does seem that the kind of rewards they get from creating things, from making things that are tangible, from exploring things in a learning by doing kind of way, can reinforce and perhaps bring back to education some sense of achievement and a sense that it can be enjoyable. Which they may not get from more conventional kind of educational approaches. But I mean, how you then do that at the same time as trying to live up to the very kind of standards-driven, results-driven requirements of kind of the education system?
Where can he find out information about this school that's using this process?
I think it's just called the Design School, and I think it's based in Philadelphia. But I think it's been written about. I'm sure the folks at the D School will know about it, or certainly the folks in the educational department at Stanford will know about it.
Good. Okay. Yes, sir.
Yes, you spoke in the beginning about the importance of observing people when you're trying to understand a design problem.
Move yourself right up to the mic.
And I'm wondering if IDEO incorporates biomimicry and the importance of studying nature as a model, biological systems as a model, not only for inspiration, but for constraints and guidelines mm-hmm. also?
I'd say we're just beginning to. We've We have material scientists at IDEO who study both natural materials and man-made materials. What we haven't yet got our first official biomimicrist or whatever the terminology is, yeah. Or even biologists. We do have practicing doctors work at IDEO, and they really help us understand how people do things in the medical world. But I think it's inevitable. I really look forward to the day when we have. But we do study natural systems, both at a behavioral level and at a material level. And I mean, there's so much inspiration to be gained. And of course, I mean, you know, but I mean, Janine Benyus has written some great books on biomimicry as a source of inspiration for designers. And if you're interested in it, I would thoroughly recommend you read some of her work.
Wonderful. Now, unfortunately, we're coming to the end, so we have time only for one more question. So the pressure's on. Make it a really great one.
It's a good question. Sorry.
Walk right up to the microphone. Okay. Big outdoor voice.
So it sounds like you've done quite a bit of thinking about healthcare, and I was wondering if you had kind of come across any new paradigms for healthcare in terms of, you know, giving care or anything that you find more efficient.
Well, actually, I think I have, but mostly they're not in the United States. Some of the most interesting ones I've come across have been in India. So the Aravind Eye Care Hospital, for those of you who may have read about it in C.K. Prahalad's book, The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, but I visited that institution, which is the world's biggest eye hospital. They do 250,000 operations a year, 60% of them for free, and yet are kind of cash flow positive. I mean, amazing. They're incredibly efficient, but they're also incredibly innovative, and they're constantly innovating and constantly prototyping new ways of doing things to improve the way that they deliver eye care. And they're using high technology, they're using very simple ideas, and they're using ideas that are very appropriate for that culture that may not be appropriate for the West, and they're now the world's they're the biggest teaching hospital for eye care in the developing world. They're also the biggest manufacturer of the lenses that replace our lenses in cataract surgery in the developing world. They've become this. They're a kind of phenomena, really. And I think there are other examples like that. There are heart hospitals in India which are similarly incredibly efficient and very innovative. The Apollo Hospital system in Hyderabad had the first walk-in CT scanning centers long before we had them here in the United States. I mean, so I think you can go to these places where there are kind of extreme users and find really interesting innovations. And that's one of the things that I really believe in, that the source of inspiration when it comes to watching people and observing doesn't necessarily come from looking at the normal market or the normal people. It comes from looking at extreme users and seeing what they do differently.
And that brings us to the end of this conversation. This is InForum with the Commonwealth. Thank you so much to join me in thanking Tim and his book, Change by Design, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Now this meeting of InForum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.